So let me start, since time is running. Obviously, this is the last talk. You are all tired. I am tired. So this will be fairly lightweight and is addressed to the 90% professional stem cell people, and the other 10% can clean up their inbox. So this is work that's been done, collaboration with Ali Brivenlow at Rockefeller, done by a group of physics postdocs and students. None of these individuals, Arya in particular, knew a clue about development or stem cell biology when they joined us, and nevertheless it shows, which should encourage the students, that even in a subject as ostensibly complex and deep as development, gifted amateurs can indeed play a role. My title here, which is Synthetic Embryology, etc., the red arrow through the synthetic embryology, is to remind me to tell you that a review of this with this title, submitted to a popular magazine by myself and two others, we were explicitly and formally forbidden to use the term synthetic embryology by that journal, which is why I now use it in all talks I give. But it is, I warn you, a dangerous term in America, along with many others, such as fetus and abortion and everything. Okay, anyway, so if you take any developmental biologist, a proper one, not me, and you poke on them a bit as to say, what subject should I study, they will eventually come out with Victor Hamburger's adage, which is to say, the embryo is our only teacher and the only one which is always correct, from Mr. Hamburger, who was a student of Spayman and lived to be 100, so who could argue with him? However, that adage, though true, must be amended because the utterances of the embryo are rather Delphic. So it tells you something, but it's not clear what it's telling you. That is particularly acute in the case of mammalian development, and this talk will be largely a illustration of why you have to resort to synthetic systems for mammals, and of course human in particular. And you would infer from Arye's talk a couple of days ago that the depth and quantitation of the material he presented to you could not be extracted from a live mammalian embryo, and again, certainly not a human one. And even getting that data from a mouse, from a monkey embryo, requires considerable sacrifice on the part of the monkey. So this will sort of be the toolkit of what we talk about, and the general notion is that we understand it by building it. Now, our depth of understanding of human development is indeed profoundly, we are profoundly ignorant about human development. And to make that point, I show you my favorite slide on that score, which is from this book from Claudio Stern on gastrulation that you, hopefully many of you have hefted the weight of. It's a multi-authored volume with wonderful chapters on all the model organisms you know. And at the end, there is a forlorn chapter entitled Other Mammals, in which appear with equal billing this creature and that creature. I do not exaggerate. Now, this is not to denigrate in any way the armadillo shown here, which is actually rather interesting embryologically since it always gives birth to quadruplets and is in addition very beloved, as you know, in the Lone Star State, Texas, where it is a excuse or a motivation for them to exercise their Second Amendment rights and shoot anything that moves. And this is a very common target because it's slow moving and doesn't shoot back. Now, so much for the armadillo, but we are very ignorant about human development. Now, as Arye and others told you, a very common and very stereotyped stage in mammalian development is the blastocyst stage. And the blastocyst is very well studied in mouse. The structure with three different lineages results from two binary decisions and the process by which the initially unstructured egg gives rise to these three lineages has been wonderfully worked out by many people. I will not go into it, but it's a wonderful example of lineage segregation using all the mechanisms you could imagine. Asymmetric division, bistable gene networks, chemotaxis, cell sorting, and all the rest. By contrast, once this blastocyst implants in mother, the geometry is highly, highly variable. mouse and human, I show you, are two extremes. But even something like a cow, what it does is has more or less the opposition of two sheets of cells, fetus and mother, and does not have this invasive trophoblast, which is characteristic of human and primates, but not of many other things. The self-organization of these extraembryonic tissues and how they interact with mother is highly understudied, and of course, you can see why. Who would want to have a cow in the lab? But nevertheless, it's a very interesting problem and obviously of medical relevance. If you were to ask someone to show you a human embryo around the time of gastrulation, they would most likely show you this one image from the so-called Carnegie collection collected around 1950 by means we don't inquire about, which shows you a human embryo. And what's of interest here is a large amount here, which I've cut off, which is how the embryo has embedded in the uterine wall. There is an asymmetry between this dense epithelial layer, which is called the epiblast, which will give rise to the embryo proper. There is a structural asymmetry, which is not drawn properly here, between the upper part of the dome and the epiblast, which is structurally very important. And then there's all this other stuff down here. Now, so to a naive observer, what's of interest is not so much this slab of cells, but everything else. And of course, everything else is essential for producing a viable offspring. In the area of synthetic systems, I should remark, going back a step, that two groups, Nicolas Grivron in Holland and Yamanaka of iPS fame, have made from these cell lines, which you have for mouse, synthetic blastocysts, which look sort of nice, like those things do. However, they, when implanted in mother mouse, they do not develop further. So clearly we are missing something, even in the simplest, best studied of system. But of course, again, to illustrate methodological epistemology, we have a wonderful assay for a functional blastocyst, i.e. has to implant and produce a baby mouse. That feat, again, just for your general background, that feat has been accomplished in the case of mouse via making an oocyte. So a Japanese group has taken a skin cell from a mouse, turned it back to a pluripotent state, matured it to an oocyte using tissue from a real embryo, fertilized the oocyte, put the blastocyst back into mother mouse, and produced viable mouse offspring. So people have cloned mice from skin cells. They have not made blastocysts from the three cell lines and gotten this to somehow assemble properly or the cell layers to talk to each other properly. But I'm willing to bet that will be solved because you have a very clear assay, and given a good assay, biologists will find an answer, a route to it. Now, the problem that concerns me more specifically is, as Arye already showed you, these various cultures we have, or he developed in our group, for looking at the early patterning of human cells that mimics gastrulation. So this is the mouse implanted embryo. You see out here the epiblast, which is cup-shaped. You see a second layer, the so-called visceral endoderm, which will be very important in signaling and defining the anterior-posterior axes. And you see here a cartoon from a noted embryologist, Patrick Tam, who 10 years before we got into the business was happy to conceptualize the mouse embryo as a disc. So we took him at his word, retrospectively, and as Arye showed you, produced these micropattern human stem cell colonies, which differentiated nicely into the molecular markers of indicating gastrulation. So the markers that, in a different geometry, would indicate the anterior-posterior axis. And a salient feature of these colonies, and obviously of, I guess, some interest to a group that is interested on patterning and scale size and all this, is that, as Arye already showed you, as you shrink the size, what you do is you squeeze out the middle and you preserve, grosso modo, the physical dimensions of the outermost rings as you squeeze it down. Now, I will not give a talk on the sort of mechanisms for the signaling in much detail, but rather sort of superficially mention a couple of related topics. But let me just, since it's published here, just make the remark and then hopefully ask you to read the paper. is that in the case of BMP, the molecular reasons for these patterning can be attributed to both the localization of receptors, i.e. where they are in the cells, and particularly whether they're apical or basally accessible, and these are apical basal polarized cell layers. And secondly, working in the same direction, the fact that there is a secreted inhibitor. In the case of BMP, the relevant thing is called noggin, but you don't care about the names. And that secreted inhibitor is like a dome, high in the center, low at the edges, and that is giving you a spatial pattern. Now, I just want you to recall back an entire month to the talk of Ramanathan, who discussed a rather heroic experiment that he, or actually Zhang, did in mouse, wherein he showed, and let's go back a step here, he showed, so in mouse, of course, if you look at this cartoon, you see that there's a hollow cavity in the embryo, runs from top to bottom, and we are talking about signaling, and we're talking about proximal distal axis and the signaling from top to bottom. And of course, a naive person might ask, why doesn't this cavity simply short out the embryonic pattern because stuff just floats around the cavity? And that is indeed a good question, to which mouse embryologists would tell me, well, it can't happen because the things stick on the surface. There's this, there's that. It's sort of a mess. We don't know, but obviously can't happen. However, reality was obviously much more interesting. The stem cell colonies suggested that indeed, rather simply, that these cells are polarized, and that in fact, as I will say a little bit later, the receptors are on the lower surface, and the receptors are simply not accessible to the apical side of the cells, i.e. the side of the cells that faces that open cavity. And what these two people showed, I think, as a tour de force, to show that you don't have to be a mouse embryologist to do embryology, that indeed, if you mislocalize those receptors, you indeed show that there is BMP signaling in that cavity, and it only that it creeps around the edge for structural reasons. Therefore, these people have shown that the mouse embryo craftily follows the structure of the micropatterns, or the micropatterns follow the structure of the embryo, not for reasons that we anticipated, but in fact, it does indeed happen to work out that way. So that's a very nice piece of work, which you heard about an entire month ago.
Sorry, where is this published?
That is in BioArchive. And has been poking around the journals, and I'm sure the nitpickers will nitpick, but I think it's quite decisive. Nitpickers always nitpick. Okay, particularly if it's done by people out of the discipline, and certainly Arye could tell you how hard it was for us to publish anything. But development often comes to the rescue. Okay, so now I will tell you a few snippets of data. This particular snippet is motivated by what we heard regarding Susan Eaton a couple of weeks ago, i.e., when you do development, you shall not forget cell biology. So I will show you a little bit about, in a more quantitative way, how signaling works in these polarized epithelia. So just to show you what I was asserting before, and again, to emphasize the flexibility and ease of playing with these systems, I show you one of our favorite assays, where you simply put the cells on filters and thus kind of dress them with morphogens top and bottom. So you have access to top, access to bottom. And here you show, with great simplicity and unambiguity, that if you challenge the cells at low density from either top or bottom, you will get a response. So this red stuff is response to this morphogen added top or bottom. Manifestly symmetrical. If you go to higher densities, as seen by the smaller nuclei, you see that there's an asymmetrical response, i.e. no response from the top, but a response from the bottom. So these layers are manifestly asymmetric. Okay, now, we could play more games with this. So we could, for example, now make a cell line which secretes BMP, and we see the red halo around the cells, which is the green cells secreting BMP and then stimulating the cells around them and turning them red, this marker. Now what we could do is we could take this inhibitor and we can apply the inhibitor from the top, or we can apply the inhibitor from the bottom. You manifestly see a difference in the range over which the inhibitor quenches the activation, i.e., from the top, it quenches it down to the individual cells. From the bottom, it doesn't do much. So there is a considerable asymmetry in the sensitivity of the cells to activate, to inhibitor. Note that I said that these cells are sensitive to the activator from below. These are cells making the morphogen, presumably as in vivo, in the layer. We can go somewhat further with this train of thought, and we could first of all make a cell line in which noggin is made under control of DUX, i.e. we could make the inhibitor in the layer now. We could show that with these cells in the layer, that the noggin is secreted apically, not basally. And furthermore, we could show, as is obvious visually here, that as we take these noggin-secreting cells, put them in the layer, these are uniform layers, we challenge with BMP, and of course the noggin inhibits in a neighborhood around it, and as we crank up the BMP level, we clamp down on the range over which noggin can inhibit. Very clear, very unambiguous, no ifs, ands, or buts. I.e., that so noggin titrates the range of inhibition. We can also be a little more quantitative, and these two sets of slides on the same physical scale, microns, will show you that the noggin seems to inhibit over a somewhat larger range than does the BMP activate. So it's the same physical scale. You can see the cells, and you can see that the range of the BMP here in red is somewhat shorter than the range of the inhibition from these noggin cells, as indicated by the absence of the SMAD1 signal. Now, this will strike you as surprising if you know your development, because I'm asserting that noggin acts apically, BMP acts basally. Of course, you ask how they get together, which I'm coming to. But of course, you all know these pictures of the neural tube, where, in fact, there is an important source of noggin, inhibitory noggin, from below the neural tube, from the notochord, so-called. So, of course, these are neurons or progenitors. These are not stem cells. But nevertheless, it illustrates that one should not assume in development that any signal goes anywhere you need it or want it. It is not obvious how these signals move around. It is not obvious that polarized epithelia are receptive to cell receptive signals from all sides. And certainly the localization of the BMP receptors to the lateral sides of cells was a known fact. I mean, that was not our discovery. That was around the literature and for other cell systems. Note that there's data here about where the noggin, there's also noggin from up here. Note this useful paper was published in development. I should also note, for those of you who like to do statistics, that if you look in the, I think, magisterial, although a bit turgid, volumes of Eric Davidson on various developmental topics, he is sadly deceased, you will find more references to development than you will to cell, or nature for that matter. So if you care about who reads you, development is a good choice. Now, obviously, with these synthetic systems, you have the question of how on earth you know this is at all real.
Eric, you showed that if you express the BMP in the cell layer, then you apply noggin apically. That's the only way it works.
Correct.
But if you were to have a source of BMP from different cells basally, could the noggin also soak up that BMP basally as well, or that never works?
If you were to simply stimulate the cells, I'm sorry, no, right. If you apply exogenous noggin basally, I'm sorry, exogenous BMP basally, and noggin apically, that will inhibit.
What if the noggin is also basal?
So it binds
to BMP.
Oh yeah, yes. Certainly, if you can't do the experiment. Obviously, if you were to mix noggin and BMP in the solution, they would, as Harlan showed ages ago, bind with picomolar affinity, 1-to-1, and they would never get to the cells.
So something like this. Correct.
It's certainly, yes. So it could certainly block BMP that's floating around. It could certainly mop up BMP that's floating around. Right. But it's assumed, I think without a lot of direct evidence, that the BMP is up here. Of course, there's also noggin up there, as shown here in this paper. But one assumes it's coming from here, but, you know, which could be true. We are doing we are doing pluripotent cells. We're not doing neurons. Nevertheless, in our situation, it's a warning that you shouldn't assume, which other people would echo, you shouldn't assume anything goes anywhere wherever you need it, which is a common assumption, that everything is pergol to everything. Not obvious. Now, this issue of testing your synthetic system, in this case human, in a real system, has been done by many people. The Columbia group ages ago showed that motor neurons from mouse, maybe human too, can be grown in chick. We have done the same in a different context. Got, you know, immense notoriety from this. This publication has a circulation of 1.5 million, and they, which dwarfs the circulation of this tabloid, which has only a circulation of 50,000. So this was a situation where, again, to check the relevance in vivo of something synthetic, resorted to using the chick embryo and putting this so-called organizer into a chick, and getting then some organization of the chick cells around the human implant. Nothing as dramatic as this, unfortunately. But it is a form of public outreach, which I will put on my next NSF grant. Okay, now, obviously, there are lots of ways this can go, and we're doing it. I said that these inhibitors are apically secreted, and we have shown that they can be moved around by a flow. Are there receptors for inhibitors? That's a very old question, probably not. The internalization of noggin is, however, diamond related, so there's a whole question about how you pull things into the cell. And of course, there's a whole zoo of endosomology to understand how the apically applied inhibitor gets together with the basally implied activator and blocks it. That's not obvious. And of course, we're doing a lot of EM for that. Okay. Another topic, again, just to illustrate the interest of the system and the details, obviously, you could interpolate. So this is an attempt to give you a little bit of morphogenesis in quotation marks. And concerns, of course, what goes on at the primitive streak, where you have strong wind signaling and then some sort of gradient of BMP higher proximally, nodal being higher distally. And cells do move around in our discs when stimulated. Again, I will talk about direct wind stimulation. So here, the easiest way to do that for people who are wimps and don't like to track cells, which is hard in these dense colonies, is that you simply use a photoactivatable GFP, which were pioneered by Lippincott-Schwartz in the late 90s when I was actually working with her. And you simply then can draw a pattern on the cells. Here, his t equals zero. And then under various conditions of various types of morphogens, you could look at where those rings end up. So here, we let the cells remain pluripotent and nothing moves much. And here, for example, the other extreme, we give them conditions of appropriate to the anterior streak, and the cells run all over the place. At least some cells run all over the place. We can complement these projected views with an XY view. And again, I don't want to deal on all the genes and what signifies what, et cetera, but just to say that, to give you just a qualitative impression, that as we look from edge to center, that these colonies are layered. These are cell markers, so you see a couple of nuclear layers here. That these cells, which are indicative of mesoderm or endoderm, have run out and under the rest of the colony. And there's a lot of structure, which, again, I'm not going to dwell on, is published, again, in development, or to be published in development. But let me just, again, in a very, very schematic way, suggest how these synthetic systems might be matched onto a real embryo. So a real embryo, which is here probably, you know, it's somebody else's cartoon for chick called into duty for human. This is what, in mouse, a streak looks like with the epithelial cells moving towards the center, peeling off, and then becoming mesenchymal and running off to the flanks. Remember the talk of Corson on the polonaise movements in the chick embryo, which is a prime system for that. So what we're seeing here, so how do we map these synthetic systems onto, hypothetically, a real primitive streak. Well, our suggestion here is, you're ignoring the various types of markers, is that the way you should think of this thing as all of this colored stuff should be wrapped under, in reality, here. And the blue stuff should be sitting on the top, and ideally should be joined and pinned at the edge of the colony. So if it were to, so basically what you're looking at is one side of the primitive streak, and that one side of the primitive streak is the circumference of the disk. And that is our impression as to how one maps the synthetic system onto a real system. And you are getting the appropriate movements of the appropriate things underneath this blue layer, but of course the blue layer is not pinned to the edge. So,
Eric, so you're saying that the streak corresponds to the edge of the colony?
Yes, but of course the edge is receding. And so these colonies are very deficient in lacking the sort of Polonaise movements, the convergence of cells, of epithelial cells, which stay epithelial, into the midline, and then seeing EMT as cells peel off that center.
So what if you actually macro pattern in such a way that you have two disks in close proximity?
Yes.
So that effectively you would produce at the interface something akin to the streak.
As I will show you, you can't quite do that, or at least we have succeeded in doing that. In other words, you don't want to break the epithelium. And I think the bigger problem is these cells, of course, are sitting on glass, and they don't really flow very nicely. So there's problems, but of course that's one we want to fix, and I will show you one attempted fix which fails, but we will try another fix. We are persistent.
Or if actually you scratch through the colony, use the glass to actually make a scratch, like a wound.
Yes.
The healing could be akin to self-organizing.
Yes, we then run into the problem that a lot of the signaling, if we do it after the thing gets going, is edge-dominated. But we are fiddling in various ways. Yes, of course.
So, you said, I think it was previous slide with this photo activation.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
Mixing.
Yes.
So what you see there is still mixing within the monolayer?
No. What you see here are mostly this layer. I mean, this top layer is presumably not moving much. This color stuff is down here. So it is the result of EMT. It is the mesendoderm cells.
And they're crawling on the glass.
And they're crawling under. And of course, this is why you want to see projection as well as the ZX. So you're seeing the stuff, if you look ex post facto, you can't tell here, of course, the stuff which is running. So that is a rough way of sort of trying to map this onto a real thing, but obviously it's deficient, and we're just deficient in sort of this morphogenesis, morphological movement way, and we're not getting these Polonaise movements that are so obvious and interesting in chick. And of course, it's a little perverse that I have to speak about chick to talk about human, but that's what the cartoon from the tabloid showed us in more than one way. Okay, now, just to summarize a lot of stuff in the interest of doing phenomenology. First of all, so I just assert, and the data is published here in development again, that in the case of wind stimulation, you get a primitive streak simulacrum on the edge. When we knock out the relevant inhibitor, as Arya already mentioned, we get this wave of EMT, which progresses inward from the outside in. And it is an understudied subject, in my view, although people are aware of the effect, that there is a strong coupling between forces, cell shape, mechanics, and wind signaling. And that deserves to be much better quantified. And this, I submit, is a very good way in which to do that, because I could put these cells, I could make any sort of micro pattern, microfluidic, anything in 3D, and put these cells in and see how they signal. If you compare BMP and wind signaling in these colonies, what you see is that you get the same sort of phenomenology, i.e. there's a pre-pattern in the pluripotent state, and then there's a secreted inhibitor, which is high in the center, low on the edges, and the two together reinforce each other and limit the signaling to the edge, grosso modo. But the molecules involved are very, very different. The secreted inhibitor is very different, and the mechanism for the initial edge localization in the case of RINT is by an ECAD here in mechanics, et cetera, based mechanism, as you might expect for RINT. But that deserves to be much better studied and will be by us and others. Now, of course, I am showing you all this synthetic data on these crazy micropatterns, which, if I were being more polemical, I would remind you or tell you, which is surprising to our British friends, that the NIH, in a call for proposals to find synthetic substitutes to the use of fetal tissue, which is another bugaboo of them, has in that call for proposal explicitly and by name excluded gastroloids, i.e. these things. So somehow they are afraid that even cells on a disk managed by a bunch of physicists somehow have life potential, which is indeed astounding, at least as a statement about their biological competence. So perhaps we can submit a proposal is, you know, how many cells would it take to have a soul? But that's next. And in any event, we have been banned. Which I take as a point of pride. Now, so but the issue is, for us, is given these synthetic systems, you know, how can we show they're real? And, of course, one way to do that is to go back, implement the synthetic technology for mouse, and, of course, in a very one-to-one direct way, compare the mouse and human. And that's going on with this group at Sloan Kettering with Kat Hadjidonakis and her and another postdoc. Okay. Now, I have said that, oh, I'm doing very well. You haven't been asking enough questions, so I will slow down and elicit questions. Now, I have said, or sort of asserted in passing, that the of these micropattern colonies, the signaling is very edge-dominated for reasons we didn't guess, but, you know, we have sorted out by now, us collectively. So you would like to ask, can you make colonies which have no edges? And what about this issue of symmetry breaking? So in the case of mouse, which is the only creature, the only mammal that we have a lot of molecular information about, it is very well studied, very well established, that the earliest events which give rise to an anterior-posterior axis take place in this green layer of cells, which is the so-called visceral endoderm, which shares a basement membrane with this a purple layer of cells, which is the epiblast, the layer that will actually give rise to the embryo proper. And what happens in the visceral endoderm, it was shown ages ago, is that the cells at the tip will migrate, physically migrate, and define what will be the future anterior axis. And they define it by means of molecular markers, which are inhibitors of the canonical pathways, Wnt, nodal and with nodal and BMP. So the inhibitors basically start here, break symmetry, and migrate there. It was shown actually just a few years ago that actually in the visceral endoderm here, there is expression of Wnt, i.e. the thing that you need to initiate the primitive streak, and that initially first comes from the visceral endoderm. Bit of a surprise. If it is knocked out there, you will still get gastrulation. It's a bit delayed. But so in any event, this outer layer of cells, visceral endoderm, is doing the symmetry breaking in mouse, i.e. it defines both the anterior with the inhibitors and actually gives a kick to the posterior via expressing Wnt. The question is, what is the capacity for the epiblast alone to self-pattern if you don't have edges? Okay, so this is attempt number two to make an embryo with a soul, we hope. So here what we do is we simply take our cells and embed them in a matrix which has some component of extracellular matrix. So a cue which polarizes the basal sides out and the apical sides in. Cells, after some tweaking, cells will indeed grow nicely in that environment. So here are our colonies. These are the three canonical pluripotency markers. So they're all happily on. It's happily a fairly spherical colony. These are apical basal markers. so collagen, Ezrin. Those with sharp eyes will observe that there are these punctates of Ezrin, Ezrin staining the cell. That is probably not artifactual, although we have not pursued the subject a great deal. Others have, and in particular, the group of Deb Gamuccio in Michigan has shown that these little punctate things are potentially what they call apicosomes, i.e. what these cells will do as they go from epithelial to mesenchymal and back again, as they do in the course of development rather rapidly, is that they will package bits of apical surface into these little shells. So all the apical apparatus, those proteins and other stuff, is ready to go, ready to be pushed back on the surface when these mesenchymal cells go back to epithelial, and conversely. It's actually rather surprising and a nice piece of work done on stem cells. I show you on the left here, with the same scale bar, a vitreo-implanted human embryo from a paper of these people and a similar group, Sonnenkrantz, which shows that the corresponding cell layer in the a real human embryo from a blastocyst, synthetically implanted, is roughly of the same size, showing you one of these pluripotency markers. Same size, asymmetric, et cetera, et cetera.
Is collagen being expressed by the cells, or is that in the matrix?
There's a bit in the matrix, but it's so heavy around the perimeter that is being expressed, we presume, but we haven't looked in detail. We have not looked in detail as to how the colony grows and digests its matrix, and we have not looked in detail about whether there is some long-range pressure from the gel, because it's a partial synthetic gel. And all those interesting questions.
Yeah, and how did the cells get into that shape?
Okay, these are thermosettable gels, as for Matrigel, but we have synthetic ones. So, i.e., when it's cool, it's liquid, you drop the cells in.
And suspension.
Yeah, they just drop them in a single cell suspension. Right, they're isolated. They really go to single cells, and as, again, other people have shown, once you put them, you know, MDCK cells, once you put them in this media with actually matrix components outside to bias their polarity, they naturally make cysts and grow.
So kind of like liposomes, like they came together and made this.
Right. It really started. I mean, this is literally the situation.
One. Okay, and then it divides, and then it's.
And it divides, and we let them sit for a while, obviously.
You put in a few daughters, but they weren't touching each other at first.
They are dilute. So we're not looking for interactions. We will, in a few slides, look for interactions. But at the moment, it's bare epiblast. Okay. So what we then show is that we could take this bare epiblast and give it a very slight touch of BMP, which is the signaling molecule at the top of the hierarchy. And what we will see in over half of these colonies is symmetry breaking, i.e., a marker that, as I will show you, is indeed indicative of brachyury, which is indeed indicative of a streak and something gastrulating, and indeed, you know, some sort of anterior epiblast marker. So that is spontaneous. You can characterize it via a dipole moment that you all will recognize, i.e., you take the chemical identity, the gene identity, and call that the charge. And if you normalize the dipole moment via the obvious geometric factors, you see that irrespective of colony size, you get a comparable sized dipole moment. And this degree of polarization is not by chance, i.e., this is a gray is a randomized system, yellow is the real system, and so gray and yellow are statistically different. We can make a movie of these colonies, where I look at these two markers live, we'll cycle. So this is the pluripotent starting state. The brachiary is the induced state from a symmetrical signal. And, you know, it's not a terrific movie because it's made in gel, et cetera, et cetera. But it gives you the impression, which can indeed be quantified, that the brachiary cells are coming on not as salt and pepper, which sorts, but they're coming on one end of the colony, maybe even distorted end. You also will note that the brachiary cells are running off into the matrix, which of course is what they're prone to do because these are mesenchymal cells, we presume, and that's what they do given a matrix. They just run around. Of course, in the embryo, they're confined. Here, they're not. So what we want to draw from this thing, which we can do with some quantitation, is that the symmetry breaking seems to be a colony property. It is not salt and pepper which aggregate. Which, and I will show you the alternative just to sort of...
yes. I mean, I guess the alternative possibility is that Brachyury is downstream of an initial event. So if you look at Eamese Dermin, for example, does that show the same?
We have not used... I will certainly show you what's immediately upstream and how the pattern formed. We have not looked at other markers. We, you know, there's a SOC 17 here. I'll show you the next slide. So we have checked. Again, I'm not going to show you the data because it's published and you don't want to see a lot of data. It's the fourth week of this and you're all staggering to the finish line. We have looked at the obvious molecular signatures of EMT, and you know, for example, you see asymmetric snail expression. So I think we're getting, by molecular markers, proper streak-like behavior. Of course, it's not morphologically proper by a long shot. However, we'd like to look in more detail, as sort of, again, to respond a little bit to James's question, about what is immediately upstream. So we're applying uniform BMP. We're getting a non-uniform response. What else is going on? Well, we have this hierarchy, which is indeed realized in these stem cells, as we and others have shown. Where is the asymmetry coming from? So we could replicate that experiment by putting our cells on filters and give them a small tweak of BMP. And what we get is this modeled pattern of blobs of Brachyury and SOX2. We could take these cells, we could sort them in facts, and then from that sorted population, just do a qPCR on various markers. So it's SOX high, SOX low, and what you see is that in the the high Brachyury population, you have low SOX2, low NANOG, etc. Obviously, Brachyury is high Brachyury, and going with the Brachyury, you have Wnt and Nodal. And some of the inhibitors, particularly DKK. Now, what that means is that I'm asserting that, by analogy, that this population, which I claim is the same as I have in 3D, where I can't do this experiment, has the expression of these canonical streak activating morphogens, as well as some of the canonical inhibitors. Now, it may seem odd to you, and obviously, if you remember my initial figure way back when, that here in the mouse embryo, you have the inhibitors here and the activators here opposed to each other, which sort of makes sense.
Sorry, yes? Inhibitor of BMP?
The inhibitor of BMP is not much on. We probably didn't look since we've looked.
Sorry, but you had the one, DKK1.
Yes, which is a Wnt inhibitor. Which is a Wnt inhibitor. Sorry, Wnt. And NOG is on a bit, but not very much.
Okay.
Right. So the inhibitors are in this region, which is ostensibly what I'm calling streak surrogate. Now that may seem odd to you, but in fact it is what you expect, although biologists don't expect it. Which is to say, I mean, it seems much more logical that you should put the inhibitors on one side, the activators on the other side, and that you have your polarity, your embryo, right? That's reasonable. However, if you look at the epiblast alone, as opposed to the visceral endoderm, and this is data from Patrick Tam in 2016, single or few cell RNA-seq, what you see is in the posterior, which is this column of cells, in the streak, you see Wnt3, as you expect, and you also see DKK. That is expected, of course, if you think about a Turing system. We've shown for all these things on the cells that Wnt makes DKK. That's something you do in a dish. BMP makes noggin, its inhibitor. Nodal makes lefty, its inhibitor. Lefty is high in the streak. All these things are high in the streak. So therefore, in the epiblast alone, if you let it in isolation symmetry break, it will do so in a Turing-like fashion with the inhibitors high in the streak. That is expected. Although biologists, at least in the mouse area, of course, have been used to thinking of the two must be separated and their position to find the axis. No, no, no. It is consistent, at least in the synthetic system, epiblast only with Turing-like. And indeed, it has the effect. Now, of course, we want to prove this more than just guilt by association. So we have the means with drugs to block Wnt signaling. And I won't show you, but that gives rise. So if we, so I mean, the culprit here is Wnt, just to anticipate, not BMP. And if you block Wnt secretion, you get a symmetric pattern. We have knocked out all sorts of inhibitors, which don't have much effect until you knock out DKK. So that is the Wnt inhibitor and the thing made by Wnt, which is the predominant inhibitor in these colonies, we have shown. There are others later in development, but in our colonies, at our time point, et cetera, DKK is the relevant secreted inhibitor, which is responsible for these 2D patterns. So now I simply make a movie with a DKK knockout, the same cell line. Whoops, and you just watch. So you see here, in contrast to the previous movie, that the brachiate comes on pretty homogeneously, right? There's no dipole moment in that picture. There was plausibly one, if you're generous, in the previous picture, which is reproducible. So in the absence of DKK, you get a symmetric homogeneous symmetry. Yes?
So would you expect the length scale to be conserved if this were the mechanism? And if so, wouldn't that be contradicted by the dipole moment?
Okay, fine. Very good question. Good. So you have learned from Mr. Turing that there is a preferred wavelength of Turing system. There is, however, other Turing, you know, reaction diffusion models, which are not so. Well, let me go back a step. What is also going, so you could make models which don't do that, at least over a range of 3 in radius. Furthermore, you have the feature here, which is actually rather relevant, is that you have a cavity. So if you dump something into the cavity, it's going to get everywhere pretty quick. We have not proven the DKK goes to the cavity, but it's possible. So we think it's a feature, not a bug, and sort of constraints it, but we have not pursued what's inside. You know, there's a whole host of issues, which are all good issues. But the data is very clear that at the symmetry breaking, as I showed you in those dipole pictures, we intentionally made a range of 3 or 3.5 in radius, precisely to see whether there was a bias. There was none. And secondly, the other thing that you might expect to see, which occurs in mouse, you might expect to see 2 streaks in a big system. Now, of course, here our streaks are so sloppy that you're never going to get 2. They're not confined. Obviously, in chick, you could do manipulation and get 2 streaks. Here we cannot, but of course, we don't have a proper streak. It's much too broad, and it's not. We only have 1 layer of cells. So it elicits this reaction diffusion, Turing effect, but of course, it's still very, very messed up.
So just to pursue this, yes, a little further, can you then reconcile that with what you showed on the disks, where there is a characteristic length?
That is a good question. I mean, we don't know. I mean, one issue here is that we have a cavity, and therefore in the disk, part of that length came from the fact that you made inhibitor uniformly, but then the inhibitor moved 2D and then leaked out of there. So the inhibitor is literally a dome. It's high in the center, low at the edges. Of course, here we have a cavity, and that probably makes a difference. But we have not, there's more to be done here. Of course, as I will say sort of very, very superficially, I mean, we want to do it in the direction of making this system more normal, which means wrapping another layer of cells around it, which I will show you briefly. Yeah, Tamar?
But I wonder whether the data where you measure the sort of polarity of,
yes,
the aggregate is really answering definitively about scaling or not. Because, you know, you show there's a polarity.
Yes, yes.
Which, irrespective of the size, but you didn't show how actually it decayed. And so yes. I wonder whether you could rescue some scaling argument,
yes,
in spite,
yes,
of that.
Yes, okay, fine. It is very sloppy data, I concede.
I didn't say that.
it's fair. No, we agree it's very sloppy data. It's not, you know, it has yet to, you know, a little homunculus has yet to come out of the gel. So we're not there yet. So I agree with you. what you would want, the first thing I think you would want is to get a proper looking streak, i.e. something which is an epithelium with stuff peeling off. And until we do that, we're not going to fuss with the 100 other problems with this system. So our goal is to sort of get that part right. Yes, Boris?
So I guess two questions on related. So the difference of length scale, so can you suppress a wind altogether?
Yes.
And grow it into a bigger blob, and then wash out the inhibitor and start patterning a larger territory?
You could certainly, okay, if you make the things much bigger, they start spontaneously differentiating. Must be said. We have a factor of 3 in radius, which we thought sort of interesting, and we're in the size range of a human epiblast.
So spontaneously differentiating with wind suppressed?
We don't know. Okay, what we know, this is biology. When the disks are much bigger, okay, so two things have happened. If you start the cells in pure matrigel as single cells and let them grow, they'll spontaneously differentiate. That differentiation can be suppressed with BMP suppression. Mm-hmm. So we consider ourselves clever, or Miho did, by diluting the matrigel 5:1 with an inert but thermosensitive gel, and in that way letting us grow the things without overt BMP inhibition. And that's what we were happy with, because we don't have to put the drugs on. In that setup, if we let the things grow much larger, they will differentiate. Unclear why. And we have not pursued it. Of course, there are 1,000 other things to pursue. Leave it there.
So the second question is, again, geometry. So here, this is a sphere. And
it flies apart, because basically the mesenchymal cells are in a gel. They eventually just go running around.
Right. And one can, I suppose, ask if when it polarizes, it has anything to do with curvature.
That's far too sophisticated. This is just doing EMT and it's falling apart. Much too sophisticated. We're not there. No. Regrettably.
Well, you certainly showed us some pictures where you can certainly think of dipole vector,
yes, yes,
and
yes,
the shape of a blob.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
They seem to correlate somehow.
Yes, yes.
That's all I was asking.
Yes.
But
that's probably more some sort of EMT-like thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But after they do that, presumably, then they do the EMT and dissolve.
Well, the brachiary is EMT. So I think what's happening is that you have sort of a quadrant which has collectively done its EMT, and that is somehow in the process of moving and taking things apart.
Okay, so you're saying the shape has changed because it expressed...
Probably.
But now going back to disks.
Yes.
Now the symmetry breaking, if I understand correctly, would happen at the point... At the edge.
Correct. There's a strong edge bias. So everything is pinned on the edge, regrettably. It's something that Arye did way, way back when, which he didn't show you, but we made all possible shapes. Pac-Man, this and that. It was always edge dominated.
And in the mouse,
yes,
it's also similar, right? Because there is the cup.
Yes.
And
yes,
there is BMP source on one side.
Right. Proximal.
Pole.
Yeah.
And then there is a point on the opposite side, which is actually sitting at the edge of the cup, i.e. topologically,
yes,
disk.
Yes.
Which is,
yes,
going to... So it's,
yes,
much closer, as you've noted,
yes,
to being a disk than the
sphere.
But in Turing, I sort of don't normally think of...
as happening
anything
in that geometry.
Happening at the
circumferentially.
Point at the edge rather than in the middle of the blob.
Okay, in the case of mouse, the initial asymmetry is very decidedly and strongly the visceral endoderm, VE.
Yeah.
So it's an external thing. It is it's a general principle of development. There's initial deterministic symmetry breaking, but the thing that it's acting on is close to instability. So it's something that's very malleable, and you are just giving it a very definitive kick in one direction, which is what the VE does. And what we have uncovered, which I think is a rationalization for why you do synthetic embryology, is that, which you cannot do in a mouse embryo, we have eliminated the extraembryonic tissues entirely. We get this crazy epiblast spheres, but the epiblast sphere has the potential to symmetry break in a very bad way. But the underlying thing is close to instability, which is then directed and channeled by the extraembryonic tissues, which I think is a general paradigm, if you like.
Have you followed the signals at all? Like, is the BMP initially homogeneous?
Yes, okay. Biological, thank God it didn't happen here, because you're all sophisticated biologists. Biologists are very insistent in asking, it must be asymmetric from somewhere else. Spontaneous symmetry breaking does not go down well in biology, just as a concept. Of course, it doesn't happen in biology because biology is more regulated, but as a concept, it is very antithetical. So we were forced to show that within our big error bars, SMAD1 is isotropic.
Then what? When SMAD, the Wnt ligands are SMAD targets.
Yes, right.
So do you initially get Wnt signaling everywhere?
We have not been able to see, say, for example, yours or ours live beta human reported in these colonies, and the guys are a bit nervous about doing this. It's not that bright, because these are not easy things to image. It has not been tried. It's a very good experiment. You would very much like to see asymmetric Wnt signaling via beta catenin, and I think in a different setup, such as the Santa Barbara group has, with a little bit cleaner and better geometrically anchored, that might be possible. And that's, of course, of great interest. Yes?
So my understanding from what you've said is that in this 3D sort of cis system,
yes,
that the lumen is playing an essential role.
Plausibly, but we haven't shown what's in there.
So what I'm wondering is, are there tight junctions?
Yes, okay. In one of those earlier figures, I showed you ZO1.
Okay.
And so I have it here, and in the published paper, there's actually ZO1 when these things are breaking down. So that seems to be intact.
Yeah. And my question is, so when you get the brachiae positive cells, and those cells start to go EMT,
yes, right,
then those tight junctions are going to...
Plausibly, yes.
Down.
Although there is still some vestige of ZO1. We have an image with some brachiae and some ZO1.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know mechanically or this or that, and whether stuff is moving. We also show that with the brachiae, you break down the cadherin locally. I'm sorry. You break down the cadherin, and also you start breaking down the collagen.
Mm-hmm. So my question is, then that changes like the geometry or the topology
of the
system, and is there an associated change?
We are too crude to ascertain that,
mm-hmm.
And how we would ask those questions is simply to make synthetically a shape in 3D. Plate the cells on it, give it any curvature we want, and then just look at how they signal. Much cleaner. Mm-hmm. And look at everything inside. Stimulate. So these things are much too fragile and dynamic, and they're sort of falling apart eventually. So they're good for what they're used for, and all these other questions are interesting, but they're much better addressed by going back to the system de novo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I will give you a few words about where this is going, because these are the conclusions. Symmetric BMP4, we just want symmetry breaking. We see the appropriate markers. The symmetry breaking is a colony property, not spatial sorting. And, closed compartment is potentially relevant. Now, obviously, we want to go further, and that's I'm very good on time. And that's a bit of a mess. We would very much like to put the other extraembryonic layers back in. So we have devised the following protocol, rather a mess though. So we basically make some simulacrum of those extraembryonic things, make our epiblasts in the gel. Because these are thermosensitive gels, we could lower the temperature, take the epiblasts out of the gel, mix them with these cells in solution, and then put them back in solution with no gel. Of course, no gel because we now have a second layer of cells which wraps around that basal layer. So we have basal to basal contacts, as in the embryo. This is still a highly rough process. So here are some of our creatures. So this is the epiblast layer. This GATA3 is an extraembryonic marker. One thing that we do see regularly here, so we are now not adding any external anything, right? These are just in neutral buffer. We have this enveloping layer, which nicely envelops, is sort of squamous up here, is some mess down here. But what we do see quite reliably and regularly is that in this epiblast layer, we see spontaneously symmetry breaking, as before, with no added BMP, where you see a SOX2 part and a brachiary part, still rather messed up. And this, you know, is our, you know, we're still trying to get that. So anyway, so this is attempt number two, and obviously
the embryo would only touch from the sides.
Right? The embryo would only touch from the sides. We're completely messed up. I mean, we have no, you know, where's the placenta here? And, you know, this is the yolk sac parenthesis up here. We don't have adequate, you know, this is not life, even though NIH considers it to be life. It ain't. This is not going to go anywhere. They're safe. Okay, now the last little bit here, I want to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, or ridiculous to the sublime, and a little bit get at this issue that Adeline was lamenting about, is sort of, you know, where is there some sort of general principles in development which is not just finding another gene for process X. So I have to announce for you a theorem that life is downhill. Now, you may have thought that when you got out of bed this morning, having whatever done too much of drinking whatever last night, but indeed it is true from the point your mother's egg was fertilized. It's all been downhill. Now, the reason for that is firstly that, although I will not show the visual cliche which this has become, but there is some, you all are familiar with this metaphor, the wine landscape, and in technical terms, that is just a Morse-Smale system. Now, a Morse-Smale system is something which, if we leave aside the periodic orbits, which is a technicality, is a system, so it's a dynamical system, a bunch of variables, which when you run it with the prop, that when you run it forward or backward in time, all points will limit to a discrete set of critical points, saddles, sources, or sinks, and they are isolated, and they have normal connections among their insets and outsets, right? Things that flow in, things that flow out. So this mathematical setup is equivalent to that, I would claim. So basically, you know, ones in landscape are saddles, sources, and sinks. Things begin where they make decisions as saddles. They end up at various terminal points, which are terminal fates. Morphogens tilt the landscapes, and cells make decisions in quotation marks. And you could impose on the system competence by saying at a given time the cells see signal, and commitment, you would just say that at a given time, cells are stuck and can't revert. And you just put that in by hand. Now, this is actually a rather profound, it's sort of good mathematics. I mean, as a mathematician explained to me, he said, good mathematics is making a definition such that the result you want to prove is obvious, which is actually rather true when you think about it. So this is mathematics of that sort. It makes non-intuitive, obvious via a good definition.
Sorry, yes. Go back for a second.
Yeah.
So you have a landscape, and now you say, and you have this whatever flow dynamics,
yes,
in this,
right,
landscape. That's your dynamical system. But now you say that there are morphogens tilting landscape and making decisions. But aren't morphogens part of that same dynamical system?
Yes.
Why are you pulling morphogens
okay,
out?
Okay, fine, fair enough, fair enough, fair enough, yeah. The morphogens are part of the dynamical system. Depending upon how you're doing your experiment, you might want to make them external variables. If you're doing synthetic things, they might be external variables. If you're dealing with a closed system like an embryo, it's all in there. In which case, and you know, an interesting question is, how do you then see cell communication in this setup, which I will show you a snippet of.
Indeed. I guess I'm asking,
yes,
if you're doing it to sort of reveal some sort of dynamical hierarchy.
Yes.
That you know, bits and pieces you can understand as landscapes and dynamics of the landscape, conditional on some fixed configuration of, in this case, morphogens or X, Y, Z, whatever.
Okay. Okay.
Variables,
so
then will acquire dynamics in their own landscape, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct. Okay. So I've conflated a little bit too much. this is your metaphor. The Morse-Mell system is defined as from dynamics, i.e. a bunch of equations. So a bunch of equations with the property that fixed points, you know, these localized critical points, that is Morse-Mell. So I now need to make the connection between this topography and this purely dynamical definition. So we can't conflate them quite yet. So the question is, how can we, why is there an equivalence? Okay. And that's the bit about the good mathematics. So here, I have a prototypical dynamical system. So I have a bunch of arrows in the prime vector field. And this vector field is confined in the sense that far away, everything goes in. So nothing escapes. If you like, I've compactified at infinity. There may be sources in the vector field, and the sources should be put at roughly the same potential as is this outer boundary. Intermediate in height will be saddle points, which have n minus, which have one stable and n minus one unstable directions. They are lower. If you take what comes out of the saddle points and stuff that goes into them, and stuff which evolves from the red curves, you can define, it has been shown, another closed contour in green, which envelops all of the critical points which have fewer unstable directions, which now we're down to zero. So inside of the green contour, you will find the saddle points with more and more stable directions. And finally, you will find sinks, which have their own particular contour. And in that way, you can define a potential, or the Lyapunov functional, such that everything is, such that the ordering of the potential is such that all the arrows point in to the lower potential region. So it's possible in this way to connect the arrows, the vector field, with a potential. And that's rather profound. In fact, it's so profound that I want to do a demonstration for you, which I do by virtue of this recycled glove. So what you see here are five minima. You see four saddles, and you see one max, which shows the power of experimental science to reveal deep mathematical truths, which is shown here. Now, why is this interesting? Well, what that says is that now I could take my generic vector field, use a metric to make it actually equal to the gradient of the potential. Right? So what I showed in the previous thing is that the potential points inward, but I could make the things actually equal if I put a metric in. So I do that. And of course, the metric is needed if you want to make the equation invariant to a change of variables. It has to be during the metric. Now, is this useful? Well, what it means is that the critical points and their stability is all a matter of the potential, as you know from just arithmetic. The connections between the critical points are incorporated in the metric. So that's the division. Now, the last little bit I want to tell you is actually quite interesting, I believe, and regards the Poincaré conjecture and evolution. And I mean this quite seriously. Now, the Poincaré conjecture is an important piece of 20th century mathematics, which was definitively and finally solved in 2002, which is the statement that if I take a closed manifold, a closed surface, which has the topology of a sphere, i.e. no holes in it, that object can be smoothly mapped onto a sphere. You know, your x1 plus xn is squared is 1, you know, trivial sphere. The proof of that fact was done in dimensions bigger than 5 by Smale, done by Friedman, who's apparently living across the sidewalk there in Santa Barbara, and Perlman, who is unaccounted for. All of these people have received field awards for their work, and obviously this mathematics is far beyond my comprehension, even as a tourist. But Smale's work in particular proved Poincaré by very much doing dynamics on it. And he very much did dynamics on it via the picture I showed you, i.e. he simply took the dynamical system, made it a surface, and then showed that the surface could be deformed back to a sphere. And what was interesting that David Rand, who is sitting here, pointed out was that that deformation that Snell proved can be done by saddle node bifurcation. So saddle node bifurcations are the simplest way of making, you know, making a saddle and, you know, making a saddle, right? So it's basically the most generic bifurcation. And the interest of that for evolution is, in fact, that, you know, going back now to the dynamic point of view, you could take any dynamical system, at least we've proved D greater than 6, which involves these decision processes, and you could create it via saddle node bifurcations, which is to say a very trivial bifurcation. So this says any dynamics of this generic sort can be gotten by this very simple transformation rule. Now, of course, we would very much like to know whether the same statement is true about dimensions 4 and 3, i.e., or whether there are some special impediments to doing saddle node bifurcations that prevent you from trivializing an arbitrary surface back to sphere. If so, it's rather interesting from the dynamic point of view. But these people were not thinking about dynamics. They were just thinking about topology. So these people probably know the answer to my question, our question, but we have not been able to locate them to tell us. But the more substantial claim here is that, you know, it's of some natural science interest to know what types of differential changes that you have to make to get an arbitrary dynamical system. And these are the most trivial possible, and it's a proof. It of course says that when you, again, this is going back to Adelein's lament, that if you were to look at it at a, you know, a dynamical, you know, a metamorphosis or some transformation in biology, and you don't want to study it via a list of genes, you can study it abstractly by just what are the changes in shape and state, gene expression state, that it undergoes, in what order, and how they interact with each other. And you could potentially incorporate that in a dynamical model, which does not start from genes. And I would assert that those dynamical models are probably far more parsimonious, and in the end, far more honest. Because if you think about the signaling pathways, and my favorite here is Wnt, for which Roel Nusa has a website. So Roel Nusa has, he gave up in 2010, but, you know, until that time, he was enumerating all proteins that had an effect on Wnt signaling. And there were 50 or 100 or something. Proteins that had a material, had a, give you a phenotype in some system on Wnt signaling. So in honesty, you may draw Wnt with 3 arrows, but in reality, in your particular system, there are probably 20 other things that have a material effect on Wnt signaling that Lowell has enumerated, which you're ignoring. So you may say you want to parameterize Wnt signaling, but that's slightly a fraud, because there are 20 things you're not parameterizing, which have a phenotype. So you might as well be honest and adapt these, or Adelein would say, you should be honest and adopt these approaches maybe from the start, and you might have more parsimonious parameterization, which are maybe more predictable. Now, to show you that this is not complete hogwash, I will show you one example where we go from conventional model to potential. So this is something that was done by Francis Corsi. He didn't talk about it, but did I think. It's a system from the fly where you have a patch of cells on the back which at the end of development have a sparse bristle pattern, roughly an hexagonal lattice. And that sparse bristle pattern results from sort of intermediate range notch delta repulsion. And he described it, I think, very brilliantly as a one-dimensional model where each cell has one variable, on or off, you know, neural or non-neural. That one variable evolves dynamically with a sigmoidal function and a decay. The sigmoidal function is a function of the variable and a mean a field of all the other cells. And that field is just a sum, a weighted sum of some function of the other variables. Couldn't be simpler. Geometrically, what the model looks like is a sigmoidal function. And as I fiddle the state of the surrounding cells, that sigmoidal function moves back and forth horizontally. And in so doing, gives you either one, three, it gives you, as you slide back and forth, you will see that it'll intersect the U-term and give you either one, three, or one state. So it'd be high, intermediate, you know, mixed state or, you know, bistable, or only off. So either 1, 0, or bistable. As you push this field of the cells back and forth. The dynamics can be understood by just looking at cells on a ring. So here are a bunch of cells on a ring. I change the, so I start at 0. I use slightly different initial conditions. I get different outcomes, different trajectories, you know, qualitatively the same. And the cells which are on are 2 in number. And if you look at the key here, they are placed opposite each other on the ring. So this is a repulsive interaction. Cells start at 0. They compete for who's going to be 1. They suppress each other. In the end, 2 win because of my parameters. And you get these typical time courses, which are like the experiment. Now, this is the, so what is the geometry of those flows? So here is the flow field for 2 cells. Here is the flow field for 3 cells where 2 are kept equal. So what you see happening is you start at 0, and you eventually curve over to 1 here, or you curve over to 1 here. Similarly here, you start at 0, and you go up here to 1, 0, or you go down here to 0, 1. And you see that there is a saddle point along the diagonal. And the saddle point is there in any number of dimensions. And the saddle point has 1 stable and n minus 1 unstable directions. Okay. Now, what you then do is say, let me write down a potential, which has a 1 body term and has an interacting 2 body term of, as we would say, an anti-ferromagnetic sign. And let me consider a potential system where I have a diagonal metric and I take the gradient of a potential. And then what I can show, and I'm not going to show you, is that I can take this system and exactly fit the real flow around the saddle point in any number of dimensions. So these things can be chosen to get the saddle point correctly in any number of dimensions, which involves fiddling some stuff. I then get these, I then get, in the case of 2 cells, this vector field. So this is unstable, this is a saddle point, these are stable points. It looks sort of like, so this is the original thing, looks something like that. Because once you have 2 fixed points and a saddle point, you can't do much else. Now what's interesting, of course, here is that there's sort of a starburst of saddle points. Because once this system goes here, the remaining cells can do the same thing. So there's a hierarchy of saddle points of progressively lower unstable directions, which we are getting off right now. But of course, you'll observe that this first fit is wrong at the origin, like it's too small. This is reality. This is my first fit. So I fool around with the metric. The metric will allow me to get the flow right around here. This, you know, this looks more like this than this does. I then screw it up around these other critical points and can fiddle further. The moral here, okay, so here is, so this is reality. This is attempt 1, which is wrong around the origin, is sort of a right here. I fiddle the metric and I make it correct around the origin, and I've messed it up somewhat as it goes to 0. But that could also be patched up. So the moral is that, okay, however, the biological data we have is not going to distinguish between this and this, I assure you. Someday it will, but at the moment it will not. Therefore, we're going to stop here. Good enough for biology. This is an example where you have interacting cells that you can reduce to a potential, and I claim you gain some insight from that, because basically the dynamics is a bunch of saddle points. And that's what you reduce it to. And that illuminates this structure rather nicely. I mean, it was basically Corson knew this, but this makes it more explicit. Okay, and of course, we want to do this on many other models. Okay, so, yes?
I may be missing something, but how do you have cells that have the same initial conditions that end up in different stable points?
There's the vector field. The origin is unstable. The origin is unstable. There's a saddle point, and if you have cells that are on and are far enough apart,
so the cells have to be have different initial conditions.
Well, they differ by epsilon. I mean,
right. No, okay, sure, sort of, sure.
Right. So it really, you are really amplifying.
Yeah. Okay.
And that is seen in the experiment. You see this. And Corson was clever enough to realize that what you need is this very minimal model. I mean, this is really, you can't get any simpler than this. One variable per cell, right? And furthermore, it's translation invariant. So all you need is this. It's almost nothing. And that gives a surprisingly good account of the dynamics. So you see this type of trajectory in the data, but not with high precision. So a very clever model. One of the few things that was worth publishing in Science. Okay, so to conclude, why do synthetic embryology? Well, I would make an analogy with cell culture from the 50s. That was enormously productive, and into a bunch of Nobel Prizes for these guys, an enormously productive way that allowed you to do cell biology in a reproducible way on a well-defined cell line, and all of what we know about the biochemically of intracellular signaling was done on culture cells, some really demented ones. It allows you to basically take apart the embryo and look at the pattern and capacity of individual components, which is impossible in a mammalian embryo. We can be very quantitative about signaling and self-organization. We could tag all the signaling pathways, et cetera, and areas like SMAD2, I warn you. We're doing this on human, and there's no way to do human experimentation. We have primate data around the time of gastrulation, but that requires killing the monkeys, which is unfortunate. The monkeys were not sacrificed, they were killed, they were murdered, right? The monkeys did not agree to sacrifice for the common good. And you can't do the experiment any other way. So synthetic systems have a real role to play here for primate systems. And as I said in passing, there are situations where the role played by some of the secreted inhibitors in the micropattern system for human is very different than the role the analogous gene plays in mouse. And we want to see whether that's really a human mouse difference or that is simply a synthetic system mouse difference. And of course, the way to do that is micropatterns for mouse, which we're doing. And lastly, I leave you with the mellifluous words of Waddington, which is a good way to conclude the school, about the joys of embryos. Thank you. Other parting questions? Yes.
So you alluded to at the end, so one thing that was going through my mind listening to you and listening to Ari's talk was, how does this relate to a living system?
Correct.
And so what are you finding out with the comparison with mouse systems?
Okay, very good. That has not gotten very far, but obviously needs to. So the first thing we're doing with the mouse systems is to look at gastrulation mutants with the phenotype in the embryo, put them on the micropattern and see what they look like. We will privilege those for which the inferred human phenotype is different than what we see in mouse. Look at those first. And that's underway. So at the moment, nothing to report. Of course, the other way we go at that, which is a little bit polemical, as exemplified by that British tabloid thing with the mouse and human, with the chick and human, was to put these human cells, which were with these suitable morphogens, pushed to become organizer. We put those human organizer into a chick, and then we induced in the chick neural tissue in an otherwise non-neural place, and we got an axis in the chick. So it was sort of a Spayman experiment, and got Spayman attention. I mean, obviously it did not go as far as that cartoon did, which would be interesting, but we didn't get there by any means. So the other thing which is getting done, for example, we have an interest in primordial germ cells, which we make for human. How do they target? That's being done in chick. So we're making these chimeric systems, which are legal, provided we don't have pluripotent cells in the other animal.
That's
a very important question, obviously.
Do any of the observations you've made in the in vitro system
your culture system explain phenotypes that have been observed but unexplained in either human experimental systems or in animals?
That is a very good question. To some extent, now speaking about mouse. I'll give you an example, a very good example. It always was a conundrum to me why that central cavity in the mouse embryo did not short out to patterning. I'm a naive person, it's a hole, things go down the hole, why isn't that, where does the proximal distal gradient come from? And every mouse embryologist, so I asked, dear sir, why isn't this? And they say, there's stuff on the surface and things stick and things don't move and there's this and there's that, there's a lot of muck. Okay, the micro patterns showed that the receptors were basal lateral. Therefore, the receptors simply were not exposed to that cavity. Very simple answer. And then Ramanathan came along a couple of years later and showed indeed that if he mistargets BMP receptors, and we know the apical basal targeting signal from earlier work, and he does that in a spotty fashion, he will see spots where he sees SMAD1 staining in the mouse epiblast. So indeed, in mouse, that's, I think that's the best example, that indeed the synthetic system said, go look there. And the interesting synthetic system is that you could do lots of experiments and, find the interesting stuff and then make the effort to do the real mouse experiment. So, for example, this issue of whether noggin operates from the basal or apical side is also a prime candidate for that. And we're going to try something in chick, bit of a mess. So the synthetic system allows you to very rapidly, these are a bunch of physicists doing the experiments. These are not professional biologists, they're amateurs. But they have good tools, and so they could, they're cells, and you can make the cells self-organized, you can do microfluids, micropatterns, micro this, micro that. So they're very easy to manipulate. There's issues of, for example, understanding how wind and mechanics go together. That is something where you could make any sort of shape, any sort of cell, stimulate this, and let you knock this out, knock that out, image to the, up the kazoo, and you will sort out, you can image everything, right? You will sort out in detail how wind and mechanics are tightly coupled.
Okay, and so then, that was my last question was yes, related to this. Yes. So the systems develop on a flat surface.
Yes.
Can you see these on molds?
Yes. A thousand things have been done. In the case of wind, for example, it is very easy to put these on a PDMS surface that you could stretch. You could pattern with it stretched, and then you could collapse it. Very easy to do. People have done it in similar things. You want to do it, however, with all the molecular markers and molecular tools we have. So with knocking this out, knocking that out, we have ECAD knockout cell lines, all this and all that. So you want to do those mechanical, physical measurements with the full panoply of cell lines that we have accumulated. We had others that accumulated. And that becomes a very potent package. Again, which is, and then what is interesting and acute in that situation, you could then go look at the embryo. And using the embryo, of course, you want to make your synthetic system that will somehow recapitulate it. And there are many avenues to do that, as the questions have indicated.
Okay, let's thank Eric again.